Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. My guest today is Michael Parenti. Michael is an internationally recognized award-winning author of over 20 books. I lost count. Michael, you've written so many, I've lost count of them, and I've read most of them. Also, hundreds of articles. They've been translated into many languages. Michael is a valued contributor to this writer's edited and contributed to book. I mention it often in this program. People are buying the book, Michael. It's titled Flashpoint in Ukraine, How the U.S. Drive for Hegemony Risks World War III. This morning I was asked by a Russian news agency. I'm unfamiliar with them, not RT International, not Voice of Russia. One of their news agencies wanted to interview me, and I'm waiting for them to get back to give me a date and a time, but I said I'd be delighted to come on anytime, discuss the book, discuss anything in relations, anything regarding relations between the West, mainly America and Russia, and they certainly are not the most favorable these days. They need to be discussed. I think they'd like to have Americans do it, Michael. If Americans can bash Americans, that's exactly what they want to hear. But as long as we tell the truth, that's what they should hear. Michael, welcome.
Hello, how are you, Steve?
Oh, I'm doing fine, doing fine.
Could I mention my own book to your readers?
Oh, absolutely, your latest.
There's a book I did call The Face of Imperialism, which deals with a lot of these issues and why the U.S. is involved everywhere all the time and in the worst way. It's called The Face of Imperialism. And my most recent book is an ethnic memoir called Waiting for Yesterday. And that's a totally different subject, so I won't go into it.
I think the last time you came on, you mentioned, I think it was still a work in progress at that time, but growing up in New York, Brooklyn, was it?
No, in New York.
In New York.
In Italian Harlem.
Oh, in Italian Harlem, yeah. And I think I mentioned something about I grew up in inner city Boston. A little bit of the same. I mean, the kind of a neighborhood that, those were terrific years, Michael, and I remember them so fondly. And, you know, if we both went back to the neighborhoods we grew up in, they don't exist anymore. Everything is different. Everything changed.
Yeah, a lot of things have changed. About the subject you were dealing with today, about the question of risking war in Europe, I'm glad you brought that up, because that's what came to me when a lot of this was being unfolding, that it was going in a very dangerous direction, I realized. I'm talking about Ukraine.
Yes, yes.
The Crimea going back to Russia was, I think, a natural thing. It should have never been taken away. It was taken from Russia and given to Ukraine by a Ukrainian. It was Nikita Khrushchev, but it never really stuck. I mean, the Crimeans wanted to get back with Russia, and I think they did it in overwhelming plebiscite, in effect.
Oh, indeed, 96.77% with an 83% turnout.
Yeah, and probably those figures aren't all that real. I mean, I don't even know, but there's no doubting that the overwhelming majority of them wanted to go back. But to then start demonizing Putin, what struck me is about that, Stephen, was the U.S. media's treatment, the terminology that was used. When the Kiev uprising was happening, a coup was occurring, they overthrew an elected government. With that government was no great bargain, I'll admit, but it was the elected government, overthrew that government and used all sorts of force. Blackwater,
and it's now
Blackwater,
called Academy. Blackwater,
and these people who were doing every sort of disruption and funding it. I mean, how do you keep 10,000 people camping out on the street for 3 months?
They paid them off, Michael.
Yeah, that costs millions of dollars. That costs millions of dollars to do. How do you produce crowds of them all wearing perfectly synchronized T-shirts with the right colors and the banners and this and that? And yet they were just called protesters, very democratic sounding term, the protesters, the people who were speaking out, you know, and all that sort of thing. Now, in eastern Ukrainian, when these Russian language people were taking a stance against the Kiev coup, they were called terrorists, and they were called attackers, secessionists, and the like. Well, they were playing for real. I mean, they just shot down another helicopter today. Was the story? Did you see today's news?
I caught a headline that they shot down a helicopter and killed 14 Ukrainian soldiers, including a general.
Yeah. Well, the thing that I want to point out is what was Putin doing here? As far as I know, he did not call for those independent little votes that the eastern Ukrainians were taking a few weeks ago.
Oh, just the opposite, Michael. He wanted the referendum. He said publicly he wanted the referendums postponed. He didn't want the eastern Ukrainians denied, but he urged them to postpone the referendums. So he took it. He's been so conciliatory, so diplomatic. He and Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, they've literally gone all out for peaceful conflict resolution. And what does Putin get in return? Just unrelenting bashing, including Russia bashing overall. And, you know, the truth
exactly.
is, you've written a lot about propaganda, and you know the way it works. And, I mean, literally, I think facts get turned on their head, and the wrong information comes out. And no matter what Putin does responsibly, they just keep bashing him and bashing him. At the same time, I think...
Well, let's take that verb bashing, and let's flesh it out. What exactly were they doing? Even when he does something gracious, there'll be a smirky tone coming to the announcer's voice. Putin now is talking about peace, suddenly discovered it. And, you know, they will in every tone, choice of words, devalue what he's saying. And the guy is very concerned about he, by the way, has no great lusting for eastern Ukraine. He doesn't want to take it over. He know it would cost Russia billions of dollars to integrate eastern Ukraine into Russia, and not to mention the debts that eastern Ukrainians already have. So that's really... And yet, it's amazing how the American public, if you just demonize a particular leader, then they go along with it. And not only just the ordinary public, but even many of our supposedly progressive or left journalist people or announcers and all that, they fall in with it the same step as the mainstream people do.
They really do, Michael, and I think one of the worst is the New York Times, you know, the so-called paper of record, all the news that's fit to print. I call all the news they call fit to print, not fit to read. I mean, just some of the most vicious propaganda coming from the New York Times, whether from columnists or from op-ed contributors or from the editors. It really is outrageous stuff. Anybody who reads the New York Times, if you think you're getting real information and news, you better think again because you're getting just the opposite.
Yes, exactly. I mean, the New York Times, the State Department, and CIA. I mean, it's straight down the line. It does not take issue. It never had a bad word to say for Saddam Hussein. Let's go back years ago. Never had a bad word to say. Saddam Hussein was the U.S. poster boy. He was Washington's poster boy, and he wiped out every Democrat, every constitutionalist, and all that. They didn't have a bad word. They talked about him as friendly to the United States, and then he started getting out of line. He wanted a better cut on the oil quota market. He refused to privatize the economy as they expected. He kept it as a state economy. He started using the resources for his own country. And in fact, Iraq had a standard of living that was about the best in the Middle East. That's when, and he was asserting himself. Then they started demonizing him and talking about him as another Hitler and this and that. And the American people just heard that and fell into line. Oh, here's a guy who doesn't like us. Here's a guy who's been hostile toward America. Well, we got to deal with him then. I guess there's another war coming up around the corner, and I'm going to have to get in line and support it again. And this goes on again and again against Noriega in Panama, name the country. I'm suddenly blanking out.
There are so many ugly stories again and again. The Taliban.
And so we do have terrorists. There are real terrorists, and those terrorists operate out of the Pentagon and NATO and the CIA, and they're operating once again. Slobodan Milosevic was worse than Hitler, and all he was trying to do from Dayton on was trying to avoid his country getting bombed. All the ghost of Stalin lurks everywhere, or Hitler, or whomever. And it's amazing how the public just really falls in line with it. It's very discouraging.
It really is, Michael, and it's the major media propaganda machine that just regurgitates the official lies over and over again. And with cable television, I mean, this stuff can go 24/7, just literally around the clock every day of the week, and people get bombarded with this kind of misinformation, and they only get one side of the story. They don't get the true story. And you could go back over so many of the things, whether it's the Milosevic in the 1990s, the terrible vilification they put him through, and then the impossible deals that no responsible leader would accept, and when you turned them down, the 1999 war that went on for 78 savage days.
Bombing for 78 days.
Oh, horrible,
and depleted
horrible.
Uranium. Depleted uranium into the Danube River, a river that was providing drinking water for 10 million people or more.
You wrote a book
that.
About that, as I remember.
Yes, to kill a nation.
To kill a nation, oh. Yes. I mean, you already covered. I read it years ago, Michael.
And there are other leaders. There's Gaddafi, who's been demonized, and Assad, the minute they want to hit a country, then they start to demonize the leader.
Well, we definitely know what's going on in Syria, and I call that Obama's war. It is Obama's war. He wasn't the one who initiated the idea. I think that went back to the 1990s, the idea of getting rid of an independent government. America doesn't give a darn if a government is, dare I say, democratic. I mean, it really doesn't want a democratic country.
No, but what it wants
is a country that's subservient to Western interests, and then they can call themselves anything they want. They can have elections as long as the right people get elected, and the subservience to Western policy continue. And any country that dares to declare its sovereign independence and go its own way, whether it's Saddam, whether it's Assad in Syria, they get caught in the crosshairs, and regime change becomes the plan.
Right. Hugo Chavez in Venezuela.
Oh, yeah.
Or Morales, or any of them, yeah. Everyone, any leader who wants to use the land, the labor, the natural resources, and the markets of his country for their own development, that leader is targeted as unfriendly to the U.S., as hostile, as lacking in the right democratic proclivities, and then suddenly he's demonized, and he's... And once you demonize him, then that gives you license to bomb his people, or go in there with mercenary forces and attack and kill and upset the whole cart. And so the empire, that's what I, in the face of imperialism, is what I wrote, that the empire sees only two kinds of countries at its perimeters. Either you are a satellite, and you get in line, also called ally sometimes, or you are an enemy or potential enemy. And hello?
Yeah. Oh, I'm listening, Michael. I'm talking with Michael Parenti. We're discussing really the big picture, Ukraine, but all of the other imperial wars that America wages against leaders, against governments that don't bow down and play by what I call Washington rules, Michael.
Yes, yeah. And those rules are just simply the propaganda rationale to keep, to get the American public, is the public that most of this is aimed for. And they buy it and they eat it up. I've had students say to me, I can't believe that the president would, when George Bush, the old man, was in power and I was teaching, then they said, are you trying to say that George Bush is attacking Panama and it's not for the reasons, it's not to overthrow this terrible dictator, and he's dealing with drugs? I said, not dealing with drugs. Every one of our allies all through Central America are the civilian leaders and the military leaders are up to their ears in the drug dealing. That's not what they're at for. And he just couldn't believe it. I mean, he just, I have faith in the president, he said. And I said, faith? I mean, we're not doing religion, we're doing politics here. You don't have to have faith in these guys. You have to find out what are their goals and what are they up to. And Noriega was, he had a military in Panama that was leftist. They were doing all these reforms and for the betterment of Panama. It was better education, better work opportunities, all sorts of things were happening, and that all had to be destroyed. They do not want a world made up of people who are living with a good sense of entitlement, who are living with good human services, where the wealth of the nation is being used for the development and well-being of the population rather than for the enrichment and capital accumulation for that 1% at the top. And that's what it is. So consistent. It is so consistent. And as you said before, Stephen, whether the leader is elected in a legitimate election or he took power with a machine gun, it doesn't matter how he got to power and all that. It's how he falls in line with the empire or doesn't fall in line.
And a good example of a real tyrant gaining power is this general in Egypt who just staged a fraudulent election and won with something like 93% of the vote. This Abdul, he's got a long name, Abdul El-Sisi, trained at a U.S. War College, one of Obama's new friends. I mean, this guy is a vicious fascist. I mean, he's a brute. He had a kangaroo court, sentenced hundreds of opposition figures, Muslim Brotherhood people, the ones associated with Mohamed Morsi, the government that he overthrew, sentenced hundreds of them to death en masse. I mean, shocking. Even Hitler didn't go that far. I mean, he did it maybe in ones and twos or fives and tens, and this El-Sisi did it by hundreds, and he did it twice.
No, but has he really shot? Has he gone ahead and shot them? I thought he. Yeah.
I think some of them were commuted afterwards.
Yeah, I think
a number of them were put to death.
Yeah.
I mean, all they were. I mean, that's
yeah, and
that's
it's not,
the
and
opposition.
It's not Islamic, and it's not Islamic militarism because, excuse me, because the U.S. was in bed with Al Qaeda in the Syrian fighting.
Oh yes,
right there, shoulder to shoulder with the very people who we were told were our mortal terrorist enemies, Al Qaeda. They've got a global war of terrorism against the U.S. We've got to fight Al Qaeda everywhere, and suddenly they were in bed with Al Qaeda in Syria. So it couldn't be that. It's that the Muslim Brotherhood, which was actually a rather moderate Islamic group, were also reformists too, and they were not in Washington's pocket exactly, and that was why they were unacceptable. Not that I want to see more and more theocracies. I don't want to see that, but still they come off a bit better than Sisi, would seem to be.
Oh, absolutely. And Morsi was much more conciliatory to the Palestinians, especially the ones in Gaza under siege by Israel, much more along those lines. He certainly isn't the kind of leader I'd want to living under, but compared to this El-Sisi, who heads this military junta, I mean, Egyptians really have the worst of all possible governments. I mean, really vicious fascism writ large. And, of course, the Ukrainians have exactly the same thing. They had this what they call an election, and this guy Poroshenko, a billionaire oligarch crook.
Yeah.
I wrote about him a couple of times. I said he made his money the old-fashioned way. He stole it. But he was also part of the Ukrainian government in various capacities. He was in parliament. He had various ministries he headed. I think trade. I think foreign relations. I think others. And the reason for staying in Ukraine, Michael, they have a law that anybody can be the biggest crook in the world, and as long as you're part of the government, you have immunity.
Yeah.
So he's got immunity as president now.
And he's president, yeah, and not an ill word, not a sarcastic little tone or anything, and not a sarcastic snipe at him or anything. He's you never get the hint in the U.S. media that there are millions of people in Ukraine who saw this regime change, did not see it as a democratic process, but saw it as a coup, and saw it as the overthrow of an elected government. Excuse me. I'm fighting lung attack here.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, that's all right. I'm 80 years old now, Steve, so it slows you down.
You passed your 80th.
Yeah, a while ago. And so how's our book coming along?
It's coming along fairly well. It got off to a little bit of a slow start, but I checked with my Clarity editor, and she said sales started to pick up. I was very delighted to hear that. It's still available print on demand for people who want it, although I had somebody email me, and this was over a week ago. They said they ordered it from Amazon, and they were told they would get immediate delivery, and I think they got the book in 2 days. So anybody can go to Amazon and buy the book. And dare I say, unless they changed it, Amazon was offering what I consider an outrageous discount. I was shocked at the low price that Amazon is selling it for. But if it sells books, the reason I was interested in doing this, Michael, and I'm sure you too, it's to get the word out there on the important, truthful information on what's going on. And you contributed a very, very important chapter, and others did too. And I was really delighted that the chapters largely did not overlap. Every contributor, 22 of them, including myself, we really covered different vital issues of the Ukrainian story. And if anybody wants to know what's going on in Ukraine and why it matters and what might likely follow what's going on now, I'll tell you, get hold of the book. I mean, we're not making any money on it.
Well, I'm certainly not, but I hope, and I want to embarrass you. I do want to embarrass you in front of your listeners. I hope I do get a copy sent to me.
Oh, you will get a copy. I have not gotten,
good.
Mike, I get several copies because I was the editor, but I haven't gotten them yet.
And
my
My
editor told me that because it's still print on demand until I think the 1st of June, then it goes into mass distribution through the distributor. I don't understand their process, but this was explained to me very briefly. So I don't have my copies yet, but you'll get it. Everybody, as long as you sent your address to Clarity's editor, Diana Collier, everybody will get copies of the book, absolutely. And if anybody doesn't, I want them to let me know about it, because I'll see to it that they get a copy. But they will. That Diana is superb. She's a marvelous person to work with. And I never imagined being the editor of a book at all, Michael. I had asked Diana, this was at the beginning of March, if Clarity Press was planning a book on Ukraine. And I simply said to her, if you are, I'd love to contribute to it. And she jumped right on the idea. I have a feeling maybe they were discussing it.
Yeah, let's talk about the book's content itself rather than this.
Okay, she asked me to be the editor, and I couldn't turn her down.
Right.
But
the situation is what? I mean, I can't seem to get any news, and I'm trying to. It does not seem like it's cooling off in eastern Ukraine, not with the shooting down of a helicopter yesterday. I'm just wondering, the Ukrainians are probably moving regular troops into eastern Ukraine, and that's probably going to calm it down or suppress it down. I mean, Odessa, isn't it?
Odessa. About the massacre down there?
That was just reported as a number of people died in a fire that was there. And that wasn't what happened at all. They were trapped in that building, and they were fired upon, and the building was set fire, and it was attacked, and they were burned. They were trapped and burned. They were murdered in this building. They were killed, and yet the media can the mainstream media can report these things as innocent facts. If it's the NATO side doing the killing, you know. But it was a terrible amount of killing. They entrapped people there. People who were trying to get out were shot dead. And really, passing one sentence for that happening. And so right now, I'm just trying to understand all that news. Ukraine has been kicked off the front pages because of the latest mass shooting at Santa Barbara here or something. And maybe that's it. But I'm just trying to figure out what they've gotten their new election. They've got their new phony oligarch in office, as you just described him beautifully. But I guess these people are going to keep fighting, or they're going to stop. I kind of hope they stop, because it can't lead to a good situation.
They're very courageous people, Michael. I call them Ukraine's best and bravest. I mean, these are just ordinary people. They're factory workers. They're farmers. They're miners. They're shopkeepers. They want democracy. They want the real thing. They don't. They reject. Junta rule. Well, junta, bad word. I guess you could call it junta rule. They reject fascist rule in Kiev, and that's exactly what it is. And they want fundamental human and civil rights, and that's what they're fighting.
Right.
I mean, it's just amazing that they're literally willing to put their bodies on the line and risk death or serious injury to fight for the things that they want. But they're doing it, and they're courageous, and they're keeping it up. And I think quite a number of them are involved.
Against very, very superior firepower.
Oh, absolutely.
Helicopter gunships and tanks and all of that, yeah.
Ukraine, the powers that be in Kiev, Michael, what they did, a lot of the regular army troops were very reluctant to attack their own people. There were battalions that were just saying, we're not going to fire on these people. They simply laid down their arms, and some of them even joined them. And I think what Ukraine did, they formed what they called a National Guard, thousands of more extremist types. And then you have these groups like the Right Sector that became a political party. I mean,
right.
These people are overt fascists with all the insignia and so on. I mean the SS, SS insignia and Iron Crosses and Celtic Crosses and things like that. And the Sieg Heils in public. I mean, these people are real neo-Nazis. They have these people involved and other extremists like-minded like they are. And these are some of the elements that are fighting in Ukraine. Plus, the Blackwater types, hundreds of them, they were hired either by local oligarchs. I think they put up the money, but maybe Washington is involved in this as well. And you get these trained killers that are going in to murder people, targeting civilians. They're shelling neighborhoods. They shell the school. I mean, this is vicious stuff going on.
Well, there's no question that the U.S. was financing. We have what's her name, Nolan.
Victoria Nuland,
Nuland, Assistant Secretary of State, who said we put $5 billion into this operation.
She sure did.
So you know, we know that money was no object here. They had resources of all kinds.
But of course, that's pocket change, Michael, compared to the trillions they spend fighting all the imperial wars. So $5 billion, my God, the Pentagon spills that without even noticing it's gone. So, I mean, that really is buying a revolution on the cheap. But she admitted it publicly. She was caught on tape, a hacked tape, a conversation with Washington's ambassador in Kiev, a guy named Pyatt. I forget his first name. I think it was Jeffrey Pyatt. And she was caught on tape saying this thing and saying some very nasty things about the Eastern Europeans, the kind of language you don't repeat on a program like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. About Western Europeans too. The EU.
The EU countries.
She told the EU to go screw themselves. She used a stronger word than that. Yeah.
Indeed so. Indeed so. And it's right here on tape. I wrote an article about it, and I had a video of her conversation. I mean, you could clearly understand her voice. I never heard the ambassador's voice before, so I can't vouch for him, but I assume she was talking to him. But I've heard her voice many times, and it clearly was her speaking. I mean, just outrageous kind of stuff. She was the point person, Washington's point person, in overthrowing the Ukrainian government. And I agree with you, Michael. It was no jewel of a government. Viktor Yanukovych, the president, he was the guy in 2004 who was ousted in the Orange Revolution, the first one, and he was reelected by the Ukrainian people in 2010, and then ousted again by people who simply got bamboozled into believing that, you know, we're really going to give you the real thing now that you want. So they're going right back to 2004, but something much worse than they put in 2004. Mm-hmm. One thing, Michael, which I find very interesting. In 2004, there's a market I used to go to do grocery shopping, and the Ukrainian consulate in Chicago is right along the route I used to walk. And I went out on a Sunday, to this store, and I passed right by the consulate, and there was a long line standing outside, and I suddenly realized they're voting. They're voting in the election. There was a phony election, and I stopped to talk to some people, Chicagoans. You know, I said to them, do you know what's going on in Ukraine? Do you know that a legitimate government was ousted? Do you know that you're voting in an election that's a completely phony one? There wasn't a single person I talked to who believed a word of what I was saying. So right. You can see how easily people are bamboozled.
Yeah, and these were Ukrainians who were situated in Chicago, is that what you said?
Yeah, expats living in Chicago, yeah, and who retained the right to vote.
And they have a franchise, yeah.
Yeah, I think 40,000-50,000 Ukrainians in Chicago, one of the biggest cities in America with a Ukrainian population. But I thought about going out last Sunday and chatting with them again. And I got so busy I didn't go, but I knew I would hear the same kind of stuff. Their minds manipulated to believe the opposite of what's true.
They would. You would hear the same things that they're getting fed from the mainstream media.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
Which is why they're even being allowed to vote ex parte. I mean, way off in Chicago, you know, they know those people will be voting for the standard line.
Oh, they sure will.
Only line they're exposed to, which is why programs like yours are needed so desperately.
Just imagine if we could have this on the major media, Michael. My goodness, I mean, we could shake the world up something big time. But, I mean, you've been invited to be interviewed on major media programs, haven't you?
Very Crossfire a couple of times.
Oh, I remember the CNN program.
Yeah, but you get there and you have Robert Novak screaming at me in one ear and this, some other guy screaming at me. Who's that? Oh, that thug. Oh, Fred Barnes from... that guy, what a thug.
Well, I have never been invited on the major media. I once had a Fox News radio station in a city in Texas, I forget which one, invited me on based on an article that I wrote about the U.S. prison system. And when the time of the program came along, I was waiting for them to call me, and they never called me. And then I got back to the program's host, and I said, I was waiting to be called. Nobody ever called me. They said, well, we had breaking news. I don't know what the breaking news was, but they said they'd get back to me to reschedule me, and they didn't. And I'm certain somebody took a look at me and what I wrote, or maybe they read some of my other articles, and they said, there's no way you're going to put this guy on there. I really wanted the chance to go on Fox News so their listeners could hear something they never heard before, probably, and they probably would never hear it again for as long as they let me talk without pulling the plug on me, which I'm certain they would have cut me short.
Yeah. I was cut from the morning commentary with Cokie Roberts and Kevin Phillips, and I was going to be the third voice. Remember?
Oh, my goodness, NPR.
And they just cut out what I said. I did a recording that they were going to play, and the guy upstairs says, "I'm not hearing anything new here," and that wasn't true. He was hearing too much that was new, and it was cut, and I never got on. But I wrote about that myself. so you face a censorship that we don't have a official department of censorship, But every one of those guys and every one of those studios and every one of those newsrooms is a censor. That's how they become the managers or the editor-in-chief or whatever else, by censoring, by knowing where the red line is and not crossing it. And so people who are concerned about living in a democracy and preserving our democratic rights should also give some attention to achieving our democratic rights, not just preserve. Preserving means we've got them, but we've got the shell, we've got the empty shell, and not the substance. Because the substance would mean we'd be able to really get all sides of a story about Ukraine.
Well, absolutely. And if one of their on-air people dares go against the grain of the official narrative, Michael, chances are they'll be sacked right away and never appear on air again. And that's exactly what's happened a few times. CNN had sacked a couple of people because they simply went against the official narrative. I mean, just one time, even innocent comments made, they really contradict that official story. It really is pretty outrageous. So to have somebody like you or me or anybody to come on and tell the truth, I mean, they absolutely want nothing to do with us.
Yeah. That was true in Washington, D.C., where I lived. The mainstream media and the radio, NPR, there was so tightly controlled. And there was a new talk show guy, and he had remember interviewing me in Cincinnati and saying that was the most interesting interview, and he had me on in Washington. And a few weeks later, he was out, and I always wondered if I was the cause of it. I don't know, but he was naive enough to think that he was free to have someone who actually can tell the truth all the way, the whole truth, and he did that, and it cost him his job, I still believe. And it's happened a number of times with people who use my books in academia, who invite me to come and give a lecture, and the dean comes to the lecture and sits there wide-eyed and is hearing this stuff, that the U.S. isn't always acting from virtuous intent and democratic intent, and that, in fact, the U.S. leaders, global leaders, are supporting the plutocracy, the global plutocracy. They just cannot countenance that kind of thing. They don't know how to even handle it, you know. And so this is what we're facing. It's the most thorough form of repression. When you have repression with tanks and soldiers rolling down the streets and all that, nobody thinks they're free. I mean, it's very clear that there's some kind of harsh force being used to keep us in line. But the most effective forms of repression are the forms which so permeate the whole warp and woof of the society, the whole web of and weave of society, that you don't even realize it's suppressive. And what jars you and what seems out of line and odd is the truth when it comes out and it's said in its totality.
That's so true, Michael. When you only get one side, the other side sounds so strange to you, like people who don't understand what's going on. And the only good news, which really is good news, is that the TV cable news channel ratings are going down, really going down a great deal, including Fox, which I think is still the most popular one. And of course, the broadcasters long ago cut way back in their operation. I don't even know what they broadcast anymore because they closed down all their overseas operations, you know, the CBS Evening News or whatever they call it these days, and the others, NBC, ABC. I don't know what they're doing. I haven't watched one of those programs. My goodness, maybe in 20 years I haven't seen one. I don't even know who anchors the programs. And the only ones I remember are the people like Cronkite and Huntley and Brinkley, and I forget who came after. I remember who was that woman who came on who was more a theatrical type?
Barbara Walters.
No, not Barbara Walters, on CBS. CBS had, I think she replaced Dan Rather.
Oh, Kate Couric.
Katie Couric. Yeah. And I remember writing an article with a title something like, CBS descending from Cronkite to Couric. I mean, can you imagine? I mean, Cronkite, a legitimate news person, and a decent one overall. And
I think you're being too kind to Cronkite.
He also
followed the standard line.
Although Lyndon Johnson accused him of losing the Vietnam War. I mean, he reported real wars, war news on the news every night. And of course that came to an end after the Vietnam War. Then the clamp came down and no more of this kind of stuff. But Lyndon Johnson made that accusation against Cronkite. I tried to get him I believe it was on this program once when he was in his 90s. I couldn't make direct contact with him. I did with his office. He maintained an office at CBS, and I was simply told that he reached the age that he just didn't want to do any more stuff on air. He just wanted to sit on his boat and relax. And who could argue with that? He was in his 90s.
Yeah,
but he would have been a terrific guy to have on.
We do have right now. We have CNN and MSNBC. So there are these kind of liberalish mainstream programs that emulate. In other words, they're a thin shade to the left of Fox, but not very far different.
And that's
a big
kind,
fight,
Michael.
And they fight with you got John Stewart and Stephen Colbert, who's now going to be a late night show host, and you've got all of these kind of people who take issue with Fox about standard things, but they really don't do very much, not very effective. Rachel Maddow, and they'll make a point now and then, which is actually useful and does link up with reality in some limited way. But for the most part, they are being outclassed by Fox in terms of propaganda, in terms of hitting themes home with deadly repetition and doing the Joseph Goebbels thing very brilliantly. I think Fox does, and the liberals are really lost. The Democratic Party, I would call them the battered spouse in an abusive relationship. The Republicans just whack them and hit them, and they're always, oh well, we don't really differ that much. We really agree on a lot of things. They're just whimpering up and getting into line again and again. And the Republicans understand that what you need is to have a narrative, a scenario, and make sure you control the names and words, and so they got these teabaggers. You've seen them interviewed, and they say, well, what is it? You want to cut government? Yeah, we want to cut government. The government's too big. Well, what do you want to cut? You want to cut military spending? Oh, no. You want to cut food stamps? No. You want to cut Social Security? No. It turns out they don't know what they want to cut, but they do know that the federal government is bad, that socialism is a horrible thing. I tell them, I say, socialism just means public ownership. That's all it means. It means instead of running your health industry, $2.7 trillion a year spending on health for profits for certain people, you spend it on social services and for what is needed. Oh, this is news to them, total news. But they learn like conditioned Pavlovian dogs. When the bell rings, they salivate, and just on the basis of certain words that they learn, that they hear. I argue with people about socialism. I said, well, I just support it when it works. When it works in medicine, socialized medicine in Western Europe is much better than what we've got here. Oh, we've got the best medical system in the world. No, we've got the most expensive medical system in the world, but not the best. It's horrible. It's terrible the way people are getting wiped out and trying to pay their medical bills, trying to get some kind of a service.
Michael, it's very true. For ordinary people, medical care in countries like Cuba and Venezuela way outclass what ordinary Americans get in medical care. If you can afford it, you can get the best medical care in the world in America. But if you can't afford it, you simply don't get it. I've been on Medicare since I retired. You're on Medicare. But the contract that Lyndon Johnson supposedly gave us, you know, take a chunk in payroll taxes from us every payday, and we would be guaranteed free medical care when we retired. Well, of course, we didn't get free medical care. And we didn't get full medical care. There's no dental care. There's no drug unless that was added on by the Bush people. Very expensive, very outrageous policies. Yeah. I'm not on Part D. I mean, and to get on it late, they sock you with a huge penalty for every month that you haven't been on it. And to be on it, you can't even necessarily get all the drugs that you want. So if you happen to need an expensive one and it's not on their list, you can't get it. So the stuff that you need the most isn't available to you when you want it. A true program should be everybody covered under a universal program. Everybody has the same program, the same system, the same care. That's the only thing that can work, and it could save hundreds of billions of dollars every year in America if we tried it. But no. That wouldn't do the insurance companies any good, or the drug companies, or the large hospital chains, the people that really rip off the system. And I simply, like you, Michael, I believe in a system that works equitably for all people. All boats should be lifted, not just the yachts.
And it's not just Cuba and Venezuela. You've got better medical, socialized medicine in France, in Norway, in Sweden, in Finland. So you got better medical care there, and people are secure, and doctors make enough money and live well, but they don't get super rich. In fact, in this country, a lot of doctors don't get super rich either. They're stuck working for HMOs, but there are things like Sutter and Alta Bates and Kaiser and all these others where certain people at the top are making millions of dollars, and the doctors aren't really doing all that well. They're working very hard and making not very much, it turns out.
Well, that's right. They're salaried, and the more money they save the HMO, the larger their bonuses are. So they're incentivized to deny treatment instead of give treatment. What kind of a system is that? And Obamacare, of course, is really has a lot of these things in it. The fine print. We're still trying to figure out all the fine print in Obamacare, but overall, it's an abominable system. If you're impoverished and you had nothing, Obamacare is great. You get something you never had before. But for ordinary people, you know, working people, maybe the company supply health insurance, that's the way it always worked for me. That worked just fine. But over the years, the system just kept deteriorating, and the system we have now is really, it's like fast food health care. I mean, you simply don't get the treatment that you really need when you most need it. And when you get older, Michael, and you have some problems that you need dealing with, you just hope that you've got some wonderful physicians that you're working with, and they can somehow get through the system, the hurdles that they have to fight off all the time, and that you can get the care that you really need. But it was so much easier many years ago, and it certainly is not that way now.
Yeah, I have a very dear, my very close friend, partner, has cancer now, and she can't get the right treatment, so she gets this monogram, which actually did damage to her breast, and you can't get the sonogram until you do the monogram, and they got this whole procedures of things which costs a lot of money. In other words, you got to buy your way up the pole to get certain things, and you have a system where they estimate 100,000 people every year die from iatrogenic causes. That's not malpractice. That's another 100,000. That's not the cases where you go in and cut off the wrong leg, which happens. Apparently, it happens like 40-50 times a year in America. Limbs are the wrong limb or the wrong organ is removed. That happened to a friend of mine when a gallbladder and her spleen was mistakenly taken out.
Oh, my goodness.
That's malpractice. But aside from malpractice, not when you give the person the green pill and you should have given them the white pill, But we give them the right pill, and they still get sick. You follow what I mean?
Indeed, Michael. I was
so iatrogenic illness is about 100,000 people a year die from it, and then there's another 100,000 who may die from malpractice. But it's a terrible system, and it correlates with the not-for-profit hospitals have a better record than the for-profit hospitals. Mm. They have better support staffs. They have better cleanup staffs. They have, and so they have less staff ill, staff diseases, and less mistakes are made, and the like. So again, I say, you know, socialism works. I want socialism when it works, and it works with medical care, and it works with transportation. The mass transit systems in Western Europe are vastly superior to what we have here in America. And you can go on with utilities. I publicly owned utilities. Why do we have better? The utility I have here is PG&E, Pacific Gas and Electric. It's the most expensive utility in America. California has it. It's terribly high rates, and it's run for maximizing the profits of private investors. It's not run to give the best service at the lowest possible cost.
That's so true, Michael. Right. And these people want to control the nation's water. So instead of water being a public utility, they want it privatized so they can maybe double the prices or do whatever they want to. And of course, right. Water is, I mean, you might be able to do without heat even if you need it. You can always put some warm clothing on, but you certainly can't do without water. And if you can't afford to pay for it, what kind of a system that decides to let profiteers literally do things that never should be done? And water should absolutely be a public resource. Anything that's vital should be a public resource. There should be more government help for the things that most people need. If people don't have enough money to buy food, that's what food stamps are for. But instead of increasing them and helping people more, they cut them when people need them most, and that's exactly what's going on. And the Democrats are as guilty as the Republicans. They get in bed with each other. They have a public argument about how much to cut, but in the back rooms that used to be smoke-filled, they pretty much agree with each other. Only the timing varies. The amount, I think they agree on their amount, and they just decide, you know, when are we going to cut how much to literally sock poor people and make them suffer all the more. It's pretty terrible in Chicago, I know, and I'm sure it's terrible in other cities where there simply isn't enough help to go around to help desperate people get enough to eat. I know in Chicago, the young kids from very poor households, if they're not lucky enough to go to a school that may serve a hot meal, they may go every day and not have a hot meal. That's how bad it is.
Yeah, yeah. You know, on the water thing, it is amazing because water has always been considered a common human right because it was right out there in nature. But, of course, water has been controlled, and the history of the West in America was history in many cases of fights of water. Those who control the land control the water, and it was really the water that was important. You got to... Your cattle need water, and your farms need water. And around the world now, you have these companies buying up the water resources. They even prohibit people in villages to have rain barrels, so that you know the rain comes down into the barrel, and you have some source directly from heaven for you. And those things are being suppressed, so that the water company can monopolize the use of water. Yeah, it's really going from bad to worse, and you have people who have no awareness of it, and that's why we're here, to try to tell them about it.
Oh, absolutely, Michael. We have a terrible predatory system. You know, we call it free market capitalism. Well, I was part of that free market in small business, family business. I mean, we operated the exact opposite of the way these corporate giants operate. I mean, we really thought that treating customers responsibly was good business. You know, it just doesn't pay off if you cheat them and take advantage. And we felt doing the right thing was good for business. And I think we were right, because we made a lot of friends. We retained clients when they needed us. They wouldn't use us if they didn't need us. But we got along just fine. We didn't get super rich, but we made a decent living, and we could go to bed at night, Michael, with a clean conscience that we didn't cheat anybody that day. I just couldn't. I'm not trying to portray myself as a saint. I'm no saint, but I just couldn't countenance the idea that I'm going to make a buck by stealing it from somebody else. That was not the way my parents brought me up, and I had pretty good parents.
Yeah. Yes. Well, the very essence of capitalism is all of the values are subsumed under the value of accumulation. That is, the goal. You have three goals: accumulate, 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 as Marx put it. And that all other values are secondary or in service to maximizing the accumulation of wealth. And they're doing very well at it. It's getting more and more successful. The 1% in the last 10 years has, of all the new wealth created, the 1% controls about over 91-92% of all the new wealth created. So that's what their goal is. You could sit there and say, well, look, this guy is worth $20 billion. Why would he want to destroy people's lives and do all this just to get up to $24 billion or something? Well, that's what it is. That's the name of the game. You accumulate and accumulate as much as you can, and you don't want a population that has a high sense of entitlement, has a high level of expectation, that wants a college education, affordable college education for their kids, that wants a decent house to live in, and middle class style of living with your own means of transportation, which is terrible. We should have mass transit instead. But in any case, the goal you want people working hard, sweating, scratching the land for a living. You don't want them organized, educated, able to stand up for their interests and their rights and that sort of thing.
Indeed, Michael, we're almost out of time. It comes down to the Bilderberg idea, the infamous Bilderbergs. I mean, mm-hmm. the notion of an ideal society are rulers and serfs. You know, the big boys, maybe the top 0.1%, and everybody else working for them on near slave wages, dare I say. This is the ideal society for them. We've got about a minute left, Michael. Any final thoughts?
Well, final thought. I wish I had some great momentous final thought to say.
I would say a better world is possible, and if we don't work for it, we're sure not going to get it.
Right. Okay, you're doing a great job, Stephen. All right.
Well, Michael, I have good role models to model myself after, and you certainly are one. I discovered you very early in the game, and I began reading your books. I don't mean
smart,
this to sound
that,
like
no, that was a smart decision.
They're all on my shelf, Michael. If you ever get to Chicago, I'll show you my Michael Parenti selection of all the books you've written. I think I've only missed two or three.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm right up there covering what you've got. I mean, you literally influenced my thinking greatly.
Oh, great. I'm glad to hear that, Stephen. I'm glad to know that I could be of use to people of your caliber. Great.
Oh, you absolutely helped mold me along the road that I took, and I'm very grateful, Michael. We are plumb out of time. It was a very fast-moving but very, very stimulating hour, Michael. I look forward to having you back. Indeed, I do, Michael. I'll get back to you for sure.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Michael. We're on, pre-record on Thursdays, on Fridays. I'm on live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. All my programs in the archives. Listen to them. Make it a regular habit.